You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. This segment is sponsored by Ducks Unlimited. Join the thousands of volunteers having fun more than 3,500 times a year. Get involved at www.volunteerfordu.org.
Howdy, everybody. Welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreeslein, thrilled to be with you for the next 55 minutes, almost a full hour here. We are going to talk a little bit about bobcats down in southeastern Minnesota. There's some research going on down there. We'll talk with a researcher from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. We'll also have Aaron Murphy from American Hunters and Anglers. We'll talk about that border legislation that's brewing in the U.S. Congress. We've mentioned that a little bit here, but we'll get the full scoop from Aaron. We'll have Tim Lesmeister later, but let's kick it off with Tim Spielman, who is back. He was now with us last week. He was out hunting. Hey, Tim, you enjoy some time afield?
I certainly did. Hunting is a lot of exercise, as we've often mentioned. I should weigh myself pre and post. That said, there's a lot of eating that's done too. So, sure. But yeah, mostly pheasant hunting, and it was fun. I got to tell you, I took a nap between sessions one day, and I woke up, and I swear I had the worst leg cramp that I've ever had in my life. I screamed, which is not very manly, but I did, and I struggled. I had about 20 feet to 10 feet maybe to go from bed to refrigerator, and I was sweating, and there were tears coming out of my eyes as I was trying to reach in the fridge and somehow locate a jar of dill pickles so I could just slam down a bunch of pickle juice. And I bet I stood there for 10 minutes. And I will always – and then I got the chills after that. I broke into this cold sweat and then the chills. And it was the worst leg cramp I've ever had. And thank goodness I've discovered the value of the old – dill pickle juice. And I don't know if sweet pickles do the trick. That's the first jar I encountered. So I thought, well, I don't want to do that if it's not going to work. So I found the dill pickles in the back of the fridge. It took a little while, but it went away. So drink lots of fluids and maybe take a little pickle juice in advance if you're going to do a bunch of walking through the grasslands when chasing pheasants. So,
well, potassium, they say, right? Don't they always recommend keeping a few bananas around?
Is that right? I didn't have any bananas.
Yeah, they say that's a good idea too. I've had that happen a few times afield, and man, oh man, you just lay there and try to stretch that calf muscle out. Oh, but it's for real when it happens. And
I was standing in the kitchen. My dad's wife is staring at me saying, "Are you okay?" And then my dog is like, "What the heck's going on?" And she's sitting there staring at me.
You're chugging pickle juice.
Oh, God, it was almost to the point of embarrassing, but I was in so much pain I didn't care.
Well, we're glad you recovered, Tim.
Yeah, thank you.
You did see some deer hunters out. It's sounding like it was a pretty decent deer opener. I think we expected that. It got a little colder than we expected, but I think that was good. That was moving deer. Preliminary reports, and we weren't able to really lock them down early this week because of Veterans Day, the way it fell. Right. But it sounded like it was at least on par with last year.
I think so. Yeah, it was, like you said, we were just kind of, the Paul Burr from the DNR was using numbers of when deer are typically registered to come up with an estimate, and not that even mattered too much, but just to find out kind of where we were in the ballpark. And it looked to be up a little bit from last year. And I think conditions generally were good. Like I told you, when I was, I had a deer, so I wasn't participating, but down in the greater Dovery, Minnesota area, there was probably a good 3-4 inches of snow on the ground when I left at mid-morning. So whoever was hunting down there, they had to sit through some snowfall. But when you've got that open country, you can see deer from a mile down there when it's white. Mm-hmm. And those were good conditions. I saw a couple of nice deer shortly after I'd left. And it didn't take long to drive out of it, though. And by the time people are listening to us now, I'm sure all that snow that was down there had melted.
Yeah, warm temperatures coming this weekend, highs in the potentially the 60s. And the other thing is overnight lows. I'm seeing overnight lows like in the 40s, mm-hmm. which bodes well, I guess, for hunters to get out there and take another crack. We'll probably be able to break that down in more detail next week, the deer hunting season and where some of those numbers are at. So please check us out next week or go to outdoornews.com here anytime. We'll have some updated posts there. This is Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreesland and Tim Spielman are kicking things off. We did not get to this story last week, Tim. You were gone. You're kind of the wolf guy. Mm-hmm. We had a new wrinkle coming out of the Trump administration, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that could potentially accelerate delisting, at least from where we were a couple weeks ago. Is that a way to summarize it?
I think so. you never really know with this, but it does clear the path a little bit because it gets rid of this. I was never quite certain what exactly the Fish and Wildlife Service 2 years ago was trying to accomplish with this nationwide wolf recovery plan. I mean, they've gone so many different routes to try and delist wolves where they deservedly should have been delisted and remained delisted in Minnesota, I speak, years and years ago. They had a group of folks coming together and they had a moderator, and I think they sang Kumbaya when they opened up their meetings, and I wasn't quite sure where they were going with this. I mean, how much more can be discussed? We've said that many times. But apparently there was a clause to get them out of this planning effort if it was determined that it wouldn't have conservation value. I think I'm saying that right. And the current higher-ups in the Fish and Wildlife Service decided that that was in fact the case. So this nationwide planning effort that has been underway for almost 2 years now was basically scrapped. That's what I understand from reading Natalie's story in the newspaper this week, and also from a little of my own backgrounding. So
if that's scrapped, Tim, that means they can move ahead with delisting. They don't have to get over that hurdle.
I think so, and maybe a formality in some ways, but I think basically back then a couple of years ago they said, well, we're not going to proceed with any attempts to delist again because they keep getting overturned in court, but we'll sit down and try and come up with something that everybody can agree upon, which you and I both know is impossible when it comes to wolves. But it basically bought them time. You know, let's get together and bring all these groups together and come up with a plan. So in essence, nothing would happen for 2 years. I think that's what I wrote back at the time was, okay, here we are. If this goes on and on, we've got 2 years. And meanwhile, people in Minnesota are bringing up the fact, why can't we manage wolves here in Minnesota? We're able to do it. We have a plan. We have a brand spanking new plan. Why can't we do it?
We have more wolves than any other state in the union other than Alaska.
Right. Yeah. So I think this just gets that planning thing out of the way so they could move forward. I mean, there's no planning that's holding things up, so to speak. That's how I read it. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service could try to delist again. You never know with this administration. There might be some other crazy tools out there, and all of a sudden we'll wake up one day and wolves will be delisted, which doesn't automatically lead to a hunting and trapping season in Minnesota. As Natalie's story points out, there are certain parameters to be met that are within the new state wolf plan.
Because, Tim, we had delisting under the first Trump administration,
yep.
and Minnesota chose not to have a hunting season or trapping season.
Right.
Then because they told us they were working on their state plan.
Yep.
We have the state plan now, which does suggest it wouldn't completely rule out hunting or trapping.
Right.
So if the feds decide to delist, and you know, Tim, I would argue, I don't know that there's a ton of pressure on the feds to delist, because I don't know that they care a whole lot about this part of the world. There's a lot of pressure out west, but they get to hunt and trap out there now.
True.
So I don't know. That's just me being pessimistic, I guess. But perhaps I'm wrong. Maybe to your point, they'll surprise everybody. They'll delist, and then we can look at the DNR and say, what are you going to do here?
Yeah, it seems like, well, there are, with a couple of exceptions in Minnesota, there are, I think, members of Congress from Wisconsin who have been maybe more active and vocal. Mm-hmm. So all you got to do in Washington is get someone's ear and talk it off for a while, and things happen. You never know. As far as the state goes, it's all right there for a hunt. It's just the first thing the DNR would do, according to the story here, is get public comment. Okay. And Lord knows how long
for 3 years, huh?
Yeah. That could take a while. And at that point, everybody comes out because everybody seems to have this interest in wolves, even though they, you know, just look at pretty pictures of them or hear them while they're camping or something. And not saying they shouldn't, they can have an opinion, but it gets real complicated when it's open to public opinion like that.
Well, and we've been down this road. I covered public meetings in Bloomington and U of M campus and all sorts of places when I was 30 years old. We've mm-hmm. seen this. We know who's going to turn out.
Yep.
It's just reached the ridiculous point. Tim, we're out of time here, but thank you. I'm glad you're back and had some good hunting. We'll talk to you more next week.
All right. Sounds good.
Tim Spielman, editor at Outdoor News. We're going to break more of the broadcast after these messages.
The vault doors are opening and this year's secrets are being previewed. The Ducks Unlimited Into the Vault auction is your golden ticket to rare, one-of-a-kind treasures. From stunning antique and modern firearms to breathtaking original art and hard-to-find relics, the vault holds something incredible for every collector. Preview now at www.intothevault.org. Bidding kicks off November 24th. Mark your calendar and get ready. Your next legendary find is just a bid away.
Whether you're hunting private or public ground, Onyx Hunt gives you the edge. With detailed land ownership maps, you'll know exactly where you stand. Add in advanced weather, wind, and radar tools, and you've got the full picture to plan every hunt. Now, with Moultrie Mobile Trail Cam integration, you can even see photos from your cams right on the map for smarter scouting and better stand decisions. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and start your free 7-day trial.
The journey to deer camp only comes once a year, and we know you've got plenty of heavy, bulky gear to pack. Introducing the new Diverge case from Plano. Lightweight where it counts, tough when it matters. Ultra durable and lightweight thanks to a tough shell exterior with high-density foam that delivers molded protection without the bulk. And a drop zone lid tray provides a convenient workstation for keys, cartridges, and coffee during pre-hunt prep. The new Diverge series cases from Plano. Don't just kinda be ready, be Plano ready.
Attention hunters, have you bagged an impressive whitetail buck this season? Then show it off at the Outdoor News Best Buck Contest, sponsored by Federal. The contest runs through January 2026. Bow, rifle, or muzzleloader, all hunters are welcome. Visit OutdoorNews.com for a shot at great prizes and bragging rights. Click the Best Buck Contest link atop the page at OutdoorNews.com to learn more, enter, and view official rules. That's OutdoorNews.com.
If you're deer hunting in Minnesota this season, be aware of chronic wasting disease. Sampling for CWD is mandatory in CWD zones during the opening weekend of firearm season, November 8th and 9th. Be aware that deer feeding and attractant bans are in place. Check online to see if your county is affected. Carcass movement restrictions are also in place. Dispose of your deer carcass locally and don't drive the disease. Learn more and check if your DPA has CWD requirements at mndnr.gov/deerhunt. That's mndnr.gov/deerhunt.
Whatever you're hunting, be it small game, predators, gobblers, or big game, Henry Repeating Arms has a rifle or shotgun you can trust. With over 200 models to choose from, every Henry is proudly made in Wisconsin, backed by a lifetime warranty and supported by top customer service. From the squirrel woods to deer camp, there's a Henry for your hunt. Order your free Henry catalog today at henryusa.com. You'll also get a sheet of decals, the Henry Repeater newsletter, and a personalized list of local dealers. That's henryusa.com. Get your free catalog today and gear up for the season.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Jerisline with you for another segment. Thanks so much for tuning in. Hope you like the content here. If so, check us out online at OutdoorNews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. Outdoor News makes a great holiday gift, so now's the time to boost a subscription for someone you care about. We're going to devote this segment to talking about an interesting animal that we don't talk a lot about. It's the bobcat. I've got a researcher from Luther College down in Decorah, Iowa, who is researching bobcats in the southern part of the state, the southeast part of Minnesota, as well as Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa. And she joins us now. Her name is Dawn Redding. She is with, Luther College. Dawn, thanks so much for carving out some time.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, how did you get into researching bobcats?
Well, I don't know how much time you have, but for me, it's been kind of a career-long thread studying bobcats. It started when I was an undergrad, and I went to school in Dubuque. And at that time, there were reports that bobcats were starting to turn up, you know, like they had been extirpated, they were gone from state, but in increased reports, you know, this would have been sort of end of the 90s. And that was kind of happening throughout the Midwest. So it kind of started as an undergraduate senior project that I tried, you know, using some non-invasive methods to see if bobcats were around in the area. And then I had a chance to do this for my PhD project. So now the project that I'm working on now is sort of a follow-up 20 years later.
So I should be clear, you're a wildlife geneticist and biology professor at Luther College. So do you have any undergrads assisting you with this research, I hope?
Yeah, I always involve undergraduates in my projects. I feel a lot of the kinds of things that I'm interested in that have a lot of practical seek for knowledge, kind of regional, local problems lend themselves well to having undergraduates work on them because they're sort of manageable things to get interested in and see local benefits.
Well, let's talk bobcats. This is a relatively small predator species. They're like all wildcats. They can handle themselves out there. They were mostly gone, right, across the Midwest, probably even in southeastern Minnesota, like a lot of predators. They got killed. They got extirpated. But they've rebounded. Were they ever completely gone in all of the Bluff country?
That's an interesting question. And that's one of the questions that we're hoping to potentially address. My thought is that they probably were never completely gone, but they were extremely rare. You may have had a few male dispersers that showed up in the area, but I mean, it was pretty rare. But that is, you know, that is always a chance here in the sort of Bluff country or sort of driftless area would have, you know, for a long periods of time been pretty good habitat for them.
Mm-hmm.
So to some degree, it was always a little bit surprising that we haven't had more of them. Until pretty recently. I mean, it does kind of suggest that, yeah, maybe they were mostly wiped out. And the return that we're seeing could be some individuals that hung around, but it's probably mostly driven by individuals that have kind of expanded from bigger, healthier populations, either to the north or to the south of here.
So yeah, again, your research is looking at the population in that kind of four corner area of those four states. We've got southeast Minnesota, western Wisconsin, northwest Illinois, and northeast Iowa. It's hilly, bluffy country where an animal like a bobcat can make a living, right? There's a lot of, there's all sorts of game species down there. And so it's a logical area. I mean, for a lot of predators, I keep thinking, you know, maybe some wolves might pop up down there. They once in a while one comes through. It doesn't seem like they last long, but it's wooded, right? It's an area where predators can find some protection. So your research is kind of looking at where these came from. And are there two sort of populations you're looking at, a more northerly population of bobcats and then some from like down Ozark country, Missouri?
Yeah. So, you know, bobcats can move around a fair amount. And so if we want to know what's happening with the bobcats and where they're coming from in, you know, southeast Minnesota or north Iowa or southern Wisconsin, they're not just probably coming from 100 meters away or, you know, even 10 miles away. They can move, you know, I mean, they can disperse 100 miles. I mean, and so we need to look at surrounding states at their populations that have been established for longer periods of time and see which ones of those may be serving as sources.
Why does that matter? Not to be too flippant, but a lot of people might be saying a bobcat's a bobcat. Why do we care if the genes came from northern Minnesota versus southern Missouri?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, we may not necessarily care or worry or think that they're different in terms of how they're going to behave on the landscape. I mean, we do see environmental differences between, say, northern Minnesota and southern Missouri. Mm-hmm. I mean, so there is a potential that bobcats that, you know, are kind of from the more southern part of the range may have different traits that better adapt them to that particular environment than, say, what bobcats have in northern Minnesota. I mean, they're, you know, potentially feeding on different types of prey. dealing with different temperature and climatic regimes. So we may have some, you know, some interest in that and sort of who's moving in and who's going to be better adapted to have, you know, robust, healthy populations in that environment. But for me, it's more a matter of sort of tracking the populations and understanding how they're recolonizing and where those connections are. Because a lot of places still don't have bobcats. And so the question is, where are they going to come from? And so it really, I think, to me, comes down to management and just realizing that management decisions that happen in one location or one state, you know, most management decisions are being, you know, they're happening at a statewide level. But what happens in Minnesota might be really dramatically and to a certain extent, largely determining what's happening to bobcats in Northeast Iowa.
Sure.
Or it may be that what's happening in Iowa and, you know, how high they set the quota for harvest or, you know, other sorts of management decisions, that may have a large degree impact on what the population is going to look like in southeastern Minnesota.
I've made that exact point about bears. We've got a small fledging bear population in southeastern Minnesota, and yet right across the border in Iowa, bears are regarded as a vermin species that pretty much can be shot on sight. And so it's kind of hard to reestablish a bear population in southeast Minnesota if they accidentally wander across Iowa and can be, and they're not a game animal. They're not protected. So it absolutely applies to bobcats too. Listen to Outdoor News Radio, Rob Gerisline. We're chatting with Dawn Redding. She's a biology professor at Luther College doing some bobcat research in conjunction with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Illinois Department of Natural Resources across the Bluffland region. My dad's got a lot of trail cameras out on his property on the Winona-Houston County line in southeast Minnesota. He picks up a couple bobcats a year, and it seems like the rate is increasing, Dawn. We're seeing more than he saw there 20 years ago. Do you have an overall population estimate for bobcats across the region you're studying? Any idea?
I mean, right now I don't have data to be able to, you know, put a number. I know a lot of people would love to be able to put a number on it. For me, the past couple of years has just been trying to, particularly in this area where they are still relatively rare, but again, increasing. Anytime we get those individuals showing up, if they're roadkill, they're incidentally trapped, you know, they're dying by various means, we're just trying to get our hands on those carcasses and get a little, you know, small piece of tissue so we can get their genetic information. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have an estimate of number of how many there are, other than just to kind of affirm your sense in that it does seem like they are showing up more frequently. And not just males. I would say for a while, it seemed like we'd get roadkill. It was usually kind of big males, you know, probably dispersing individuals. But we're increasingly seeing females. And so that's, you know, indicative that it's not just wandering males, but we're actually seeing, you know, breeding populations.
You're looking for actual physical specimens so that you can get some DNA evidence. Are you tracking also, you know, overall, you know, asking people to submit trail cameras so you get some sense of where they are, or is that not necessarily the point of your research?
For me, that's not something that I'm tracking right now. There may be other biologists, you know, within Minnesota that are interested in that information. For me, the you know, sort of two key things that I need is a piece of tissue, you know, so getting their genetic, their DNA information, and then the location, right? So kind of knowing where they came from and the date. And, you know, from that, I can get everything else, learn about their, you know, their genetic information. I could tell if they're male or female, because surprisingly, that's not always easy for people to be able to identify when they have a bobcat in hand.
If folks find a dead bobcat, a roadkill or something, and they want to help you out, how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so we're starting to wrap up data collection. So we'll probably go through the fall yet. We have pretty good population or sample sizes from most places. We're really still kind of focusing in on individuals that turn up in kind of rare locations, so places where they don't normally show up. So if you have anything that shows up in a place where you're like, wow, this is pretty uncommon for a bobcat to be there, you can reach out to me. So my email and information you can find on my website. So if you just type in my name, Dawn Redding at Luther College, my website will come up and you can email me. You know, there are some things, you know, we just have to kind of make sure, because we have permits in place in various states. When you're working with different states require different types of things. So we just kind of need to make sure we have everything in place to be able to get everything. But yeah, so we're actually hoping to wrap up sample collection here in probably the next month or so.
Well, one last time, if folks want to contribute to the research, if they find a dead bobcat, these species are protected. People shouldn't be out killing them. We want to stress that. But if you find one that's incidentally been killed, by all means, contact Dawn Redding down at Luther College. Just Google her up, Dawn Redding, Luther College, Decorah, Iowa. Thanks so much for joining me for a segment, and good luck with the research, Dawn.
Okay, thanks so much, Rob.
Yep, take care. Dawn Redding, Luther College down in Decorah, Iowa. She's studying bobcats in Minnesota's Bluff Country and as well as adjacent states. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
The journey to deer camp only comes once a year, and we know you've got plenty of heavy, bulky gear to pack. Introducing the new Diverge case from Plano. Lightweight where it counts, tough when it matters. Ultra durable and lightweight thanks to a tough shell exterior with high-density foam that delivers molded protection without the bulk. And a drop zone lid tray provides a convenient workstation for keys, cartridges, and coffee during pre-hunt prep. The new Diverge series cases from Plano. Don't just kind of be ready, be Plano ready.
The vault doors are opening and this year's secrets are being previewed. The Ducks Unlimited Into the Vault auction is your golden ticket to rare, one-of-a-kind treasures. From stunning antique and modern firearms to breathtaking original art and hard-to-find relics, the vault holds something incredible for every collector. Preview now at www.intothevault.org. Bidding kicks off November 24th. Mark your calendar and get ready. Your next legendary find is just a bid away.
You fish the same waters year after year. But what if your next best fishing story is just a few miles away? Onyx Fish builds on 15 years of experience, giving hunters and adventurers a revolutionary angling tool to help you find new water, new access, and new fish. Find the right lake. Know the species, size, and abundance. Get expert local insight. Navigate to the right ramp fast. Then go fish in new lakes like they're your home waters. Don't chase reports. Make your own with Onyx Fish.
Is a trip to Alaska on your bucket list? It's time to dump that bucket and buy your ticket. And while you're there, fish the Kenai River with Jason's Guide Service. Jason is considered the best when it comes to catching Alaskan salmon, rainbow trout, and char. He's one of only a few guides that has the permit to fish in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where the salmon are easy targets and the trout and char are plentiful. So cross that Alaskan fishing trip off your list and check out jasonsguideservice.com. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
If you're hunting deer in Minnesota or surrounding states this season, be aware that deer carcass movement restrictions are in place in Minnesota. You cannot move whole intact carcasses out of CWD management zones or into Minnesota from other states, and only certain parts of your harvest can be transported. If you're heading to a licensed taxidermist from hunting out of state or in a CWD zone, there are regulations for you too. Visit mndnr.gov/deer imports to learn more. That's mndnr.gov/deer imports.
Our outdoor heritage is at a crossroads. Fewer hunters and anglers mean less support for the wild places we love. The Outdoor News Foundation is changing that story, one young person at a time. For just $25, you can give a child a year of outdoor knowledge via scholarships, camps, and access to OutdoorNews.com. This Give to the Max Day help us cast a legacy for tomorrow's hunters and anglers. Visit OutdoorNews.com/foundation to get involved and donate today.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreeseline with you for another segment. Thanks so much for tuning in. Check us out online at outdoornews.com. If you like the content here of this broadcast every week, you can subscribe to print or digital versions that way, or call us at 800-535-5191. You can do it that way too. Outdoor News makes a great holiday gift. I like to remind everybody of that this time of year. Hey, there's some legislation in the U.S. Congress brewing. I wrote my column about it last week. I mentioned it on the show, I think, 2 weeks ago. It's gotten a ton of publicity in the past couple of weeks, and I wanted to drill into it a little more, have a little more professional conversation about it than just my opinion. Aaron Murphy is joining us now from American Hunters and Anglers. We've had Lantani on before from that organization. I thought it'd be fun to get to know someone new. Aaron, a spokesperson from that group. Nice to see you. Aaron, thank you for joining me.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me, and thanks for allowing us to speak our bit about this particular bill. It's a nasty one, so appreciate the conversation.
Let's talk American Hunters and Anglers for just 30 seconds or so. You folks, fairly new organization on the block, very active on social media. I see Lan posting a lot. I see you posting on Instagram quite a bit. You guys aren't mincing words. I appreciate that. You see bad bills out there, and you eviscerate them and tell sportsmen and women and other outdoor users they got to get involved.
Yeah. So we are a 501c4 organization, and we might be new in terms of activation, but we've actually been around for a while. This organization was established in 2013, and it is a national organization. I want to stress that too. I happen to live in the state of Montana, but we care about sportsmen's issues, particularly hunting, fishing, public land access, all over the country, and public lands are under threat. We say there's a war against them, and we say that we are the front line in that war on behalf of hunters and anglers everywhere. So a lot to talk about in this space, and we're happy to do it because all of us who make up this organization have had a lot of experience, not just with hunting and fishing, but public lands and also policy. I happened to work for a U.S. senator for many years, as did one of my colleagues. Land has been actively involved in the outdoor space for many years, so sure. We're just excited to bring our experience to this conversation.
Okay, Aaron, let's talk about the topic at hand. That is the so-called Borderlands Conservation Act. And you've been working in government a long time. You must love the name of some of these bills that always do the exact opposite of what the name actually says.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that because a lot of times lawmakers who write these bills use the name of the bill as a messaging opportunity. So the fact that this is called a conservation bill is ridiculous. Right. That is, it's misleading. And to that point, I would say we don't call it by its name. We call it by our nickname for it, which is the Big Brother Bill, because that's exactly what it is.
So what this thing would do, this is our old friend, Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah. We talked about him a lot this past summer. He tried to insert, 3 million acres of land liquidation into these, again, the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, the Reconciliation Bill. Sportsmen and women really turned out. They pulled that out, but he's back, right? He's trying an end run here on our public lands.
Yes, he is. And when he tried to do that in the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, there's another example of a bill that's improperly named, but he tried to sell off up to 3.3 million acres of Forest Service and BLM lands in land across the West, notably not in the state of Montana, because he worked with Senator Steve Daines of Montana to make a deal to screw other states instead. But the backlash from hunters and anglers was so powerful and so loud that Mike Lee had to withdraw that legislation, the language from that bill. So an embarrassment to him, a black eye for sure. But apparently he didn't learn his lesson because now he's continuing to hammer on public lands and access to public lands. You know, the guy for being in charge of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which is tasked with overseeing public lands, he hates public lands. And I wish I were exaggerating there, but he just does not fundamentally believe the fact that 640 million acres belong to all of us should be the case. And so he is waging war on them. And we are going after him to make sure that people everywhere, not just in Utah, but he represents public lands everywhere. We're going to make sure people know what he's up to.
All right. Well, let's talk specifically about this bill. It's couched in terms of protecting border security, and it would place, a 100-mile buffer along all U.S. borders, which is a lot of land. You go 100 miles deep from the Canadian border into Minnesota. That's a good chunk of our state. It would create this buffer and basically give Homeland Security kind of carte blanche ability to build roads and do other things in the name of security.
It's a nasty bill. And not only that, it's not just border security. I don't think anybody has an issue with a secure border.
Sure.
But what this does is go a step further. And we say it weaponizes these public lands because what it does is authorize essentially the Secretary of Homeland Security to supersede the work of the Secretary of Interior, who oversees most public lands, and the Secretary of Agriculture, who oversees the Forest Service lands. And what it does, and actually I've got some of the language pulled up right here, it allows the secretaries to deploy what they call tactical infrastructure. And so again, this is reading from the bill, building observation points, remote video surveillance systems, motion sensors, vehicle barriers, fences, roads, bridges, drainage, and detection devices. So we're not talking about like where you go into the border if you cross into Canada. We're not talking about that. We're talking about places like, well, in Minnesota, the Boundary Waters, Canoe Wilderness Area. In Montana, the Bob Marshall. We're talking national parks like Glacier. If you go to the southern border, there are a whole bunch of national parks from Joshua Tree to Saguaro National Park. And then on the East Coast, a lot of times we talk about public lands and people think, oh, well, that's a Western problem. No, if you look at the eastern half of the United States, so try to visualize 100 miles, that's halfway through New England. It's mostly all of Maine, including Acadia National Park, all the way to the other side of the country, to the Olympic Peninsula. So a whole bunch of public lands. I actually did my research and looked at how many of them there were. Even North Dakota, somebody on our Instagram page said, well, a good thing I live in North Dakota. It doesn't affect me. No, in North Dakota, there are 12 wildlife refuges, national sure. wildlife refuges that are affected by this bill. And these are not just national parks. This is where people go and hunt and fish. Yeah. So it's a terrible piece of policy. It's a bad idea. And frankly, for a party that claims to be against big government, this is as big government as it gets. It is the big brother bill.
You're listening to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Jerison. We're chatting with Aaron Murphy. He's with American Hunters and Anglers. Check out their website, AmericanHuntersAndAnglers.org. We're talking about Senate File 2967, the so-called Borderlands Conservation Act, which would allow a tremendous amount of potential development in wilderness areas, national wildlife refuges, all sorts of public lands around the country. There's some nuances in this bill, Aaron, that like wilderness areas could potentially be opened up even in areas that are not within that 100-mile border. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. And so the way the bill is written, it actually, if a chunk of public land touches within that 100-mile border zone, it would affect that entire chunk of public land, right? So even though the entire Bob Marshall Wilderness, for example, is not necessarily within the 100 miles, much of it is, but the section that isn't is still covered under the jurisdiction of this bill if it were to become law.
Yeah. There's also language that calls for reducing, quote, hazardous fuels on federal property. I mean, hazardous fuels, that's trees.
I know.
So basically, we're talking about permitting logging on all these federally managed lands, which we have a lot of that now, but it doesn't exempt wilderness areas. So that's what this is all about, right? This is just an end run on accessing wilderness areas and eviscerating the 1964 Wilderness Act.
Yeah, and again, coming from a guy who doesn't believe in the very notion of public lands, right? So it makes sense from his perspective, I guess. But yes, there are several components to this bill beyond just the 100-mile buffer zone from each of the borders. There are also things in here, and they're very vague. It basically says to these secretaries, hey, come up with a plan to mitigate wildfire and weeds. Well, okay. Right. Show us what that looks like and why is it tucked into this bill? It's a really sloppily written bill.
Now, as we're speaking, there is no companion bill in the House yet. And there's also fairly few sponsors, co-sponsors on this thing, on the Senate version. I believe Ted Cruz is the only co-sponsor on it who actually lives in a border state that this would affect.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that because that's one of the things that I noticed. Again, I served as a chief of staff to a U.S. senator, so I noticed these things when bills come up. But there are 8 sponsors as of today. There might be more in the future. And these 8 sponsors, all except for Ted Cruz, represent states in the interior of the country. So, for example, both senators from Wyoming co-sponsored this bill. Well, Wyoming isn't affected by the 100-mile zone. Notably, the 2 senators who represent my state, Montana, are not on this bill. Same with North Dakota. Same with Idaho. A question for us would be, why not? Probably because it's terrible policy and it's unpopular if you talk about this bill in terms of what it actually does, especially for hunting, fishing, and appreciating our outdoor public lands. But these 8 co-sponsors, we shouldn't ignore them. The way I framed it in a social media video I did the other day was, if you look at a bill and it's politicians who think they know better for states they don't represent, right, it should be a red flag automatically.
When I first saw this language several weeks ago, I honestly, Aaron, I kind of ignored it. I was a little burned out on just ranting and raving about public lands. I'd done a lot of writing about the roadless rule, of course, which is still percolating. But since then, this thing has gotten a lot of coverage. Do you think this has much chance it passes? There aren't a ton of co-sponsors. Anytime legislation like this comes up, we've got to pay attention. We've got to alert the public. I don't know. How worried are you about this one?
Well, I take it very seriously, and I think we all should. I don't think when a U.S. senator goes through the effort of, one, writing a bill, two, getting colleagues to co-sponsor it, I guess I would push back a little bit. 8 co-sponsors is not insignificant. It's okay. Fairly good chunk of the Republican side of things, and there are many bills that don't have any co-sponsors.
I think our Minnesota senators, of course, oppose this. We might have some listeners in Wisconsin, some other adjacent states that have some Republican senators. They need to know, don't get on board with this thing and flat out oppose it.
Yeah, well, and you mentioned the boundary waters. That would encompass all of the boundary waters, which, by the way, is America's most visited wilderness, most popular. It is a jobs powerhouse. There's already an attack on the boundary waters, Twin Metals, and but it's beyond the boundary waters. It's the entire Superior National Forest. So yeah, a whole bunch of places at stake in Minnesota and then beyond through the Great Lakes and to New England.
I guess listeners can contact Senator Lee's office, tell him to back off, tell him this is a lousy piece of legislation, and we'll keep tabs on this as fall goes into winter. I hope it doesn't progress, and I hope there's not a House version, but we'll see.
Well, if there is, we'll be paying attention, and we'll make sure everybody knows. And if folks are interested in this, it's something that we as an organization are staying on top of, and folks are welcome to follow us at American Hunters and Anglers, notably on Instagram. I think that's where we do most of our work, but you can find us on Facebook and TikTok as well.
Aaron Murphy from American Hunters and Anglers, AmericanHuntersAndAnglers.org. Let's break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
The vault doors are opening and this year's secrets are being previewed. The Ducks Unlimited Into the Vault auction is your golden ticket to rare, one-of-a-kind treasures. From stunning antique and modern firearms to breathtaking original art and hard-to-find relics, the vault holds something incredible for every collector. Preview now at www.intothevault.org. Bidding kicks off November 24th. Mark your calendar and get ready. Your next legendary find is just a bid away.
Whether you're hunting private or public ground, Onyx Hunt gives you the edge. With detailed land ownership maps, you'll know exactly where you stand. Add in advanced weather, wind, and radar tools, and you've got the full picture to plan every hunt. Now, with Moultrie Mobile Trail Cam integration, you can even see photos from your cams right on the map for smarter scouting and better stand decisions. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and start your free 7-day trial.
Attention hunters, have you bagged an impressive whitetail buck this season? Then show it off at the Outdoor News Best Buck Contest, sponsored by Federal. The contest runs through January 2026. Bow, rifle, or muzzleloader, all hunters are welcome. Visit OutdoorNews.com for a shot at great prizes and bragging rights. Click the Best Buck Contest link atop the page at OutdoorNews.com to learn more, enter, and view official rules. That's OutdoorNews.com.
If you're hunting deer in Minnesota or surrounding states this season, be aware that deer carcass movement restrictions are in place in Minnesota. You cannot move whole intact carcasses out of CWD management zones or into Minnesota from other states, and only certain parts of your harvest can be transported. If you're heading to a licensed taxidermist from hunting out of state or in a CWD zone, there are regulations for you too. Visit mndnr.gov/deer imports to learn more. That's mndnr.gov/deer imports.
Are you ready to hit the frozen waters and reel in some epic catches? The all-new OutdoorNews.com is your ultimate resource for all things ice fishing. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, OutdoorNews.com is the source for the latest tips, techniques, and gear reviews. Stay ahead of the rest with the most up-to-date ice conditions, fishing reports, and hotspots to maximize your success. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity to elevate your hard water game. Visit OutdoorNews.com today and become part of the ice angling revolution.
Whatever you're hunting, be it small game, predators, gobblers, or big game, Henry Repeating Arms has a rifle or shotgun you can trust. With over 200 models to choose from, every Henry is proudly made in Wisconsin, backed by a lifetime warranty and supported by top customer service. From the squirrel woods to deer camp, there's a Henry for your hunt. Order your free Henry catalog today at henryusa.com. You'll also get a sheet of decals, the Henry Repeater newsletter, and a personalized list of local dealers. That's henryusa.com. Get your free catalog today and gear up for the season.
Welcome back, everybody. Final segment of this week's broadcast of Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Jerisline. Tim Lesmeister is going to join me. Check both of us out online at OutdoorNews.com or call 800-535-5191 if you would like to subscribe to either our print or digital versions. Makes a great holiday gift. We are bearing down on the holiday season. Tim is down in Florida. Tim, good to see you, man. You getting out on the salt water yet?
It's been a little windy since I got here, but I'm heading out soon. In 2 days, I'm going to test all the gear that I brought down here. I'm going to check those reefs that I left last spring to see if those hogfish are still there this fall.
Good. Well, we'll talk more saltwater maybe with you next week. Hey, speaking of big water, this past week, a lot of chatter about the 50th anniversary of the Edmund Fitzgerald going down. Of course, tragic story, 1975, 29 sailors, I believe, aboard that massive watercraft that was hauling some iron ore, iron taconite across Lake Superior on November 10th, right? Tim, I was actually living living in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan at the time. I was a little kid. I was probably, as if you drew a straight line as the crow flies, probably about 70 or 75 miles from where the Edmund was when it went down off Whitefish Point. Now I was just a little kid. My family the next day, of course, found out what had happened. My mom, I was talking to her this week, and she said she still remembers what that storm and just how it was a cold, dark, windy day all day. And then she wasn't, you know, surprised the next day to hear, you know, something terrible had happened with that iron ore tanker. I don't remember it well. You probably do. You're a Lake Superior guy.
Oh, yeah. I've been going up to Lake Superior forever, and I've got a place up there. And when those winds come in from the northeast, they call them the gales of November.
Right.
I'm telling you what, there's some gales of October, too. It's tough to get out on the water in October and November up on Lake Superior. And when those winds come howling through and those waves start kicking up, it is deadly. They say that the lake is something, they kind of compare it to your best friend who you cannot trust.
It's an inland sea. It's a remarkable, deep, amazing, gorgeous body of water. Things, I think, protocol has changed since the Edmund went down. I think ships are built different, and I also think they wouldn't go out in that kind of weather again with a tanker full of many tons of taconite. But you know, a tragic story that, you know, the Gordon Lightfoot song has helped, I think, make it a legendary story. But I was looking at social media this past week. There were people who were like, we thought that was a song about a boat from like the 1800s. It's like, no, this is a modern story. This happened in the lifetime of even I'm increasingly becoming an old guy, but, you know, in my lifetime.
That's true. And, you know, go online and say, just get into the search engine and put in how many ships have wrecked on Lake Superior. It is an enormous amount.
Right.
And the Edmund Fitzgerald was one of the latest ones. So yeah, it hasn't been that long ago.
You know,
there are wrecks all over. There's a wreck just off of Long Point between Madeline Island and Long Island. And you can literally see it down in the water from your boat. Actually scuba dove on 6 wrecks out on Lake Superior. And this was when the scuba shop used to be in Bayfield. And there's some incredible wreckage down there on the bottom of Lake Superior. And the Edmund Fitzgerald is one of the really deep ones. So to get down to that, they couldn't go down with scuba gear. They had to go down with, you know, equipment that would go deep and just video it.
You're right. I think that's something a lot of people forget. The middle portion of the 20th century, there were a number of big wrecks on Lake Superior and the other Great Lakes. I think the Edmund was one of the last ones, and maybe perhaps that's, you know, that's why we talk about it more. But anyway, rest in peace, the souls that lost their lives that day and all the souls that have been lost on the Great Lakes over the years. Let's talk about something positive on the Great Lakes, Tim, and other cold water lakes, and that's whitefish. Mark Norquist wrote a piece in last week's Outdoor News about going whitefish netting up in the boundary waters. I had a guest on last week. We talked about a DNR guest. We talked about whitefish and tulipy netting. They're kind of an underappreciated fish, isn't it? There's great whitefish populations on Lake Superior and of course, some border water lakes here more inland, right?
And you've got some wonderful lakes down just north of Brainerd as well. That whitefish chain is known for whitefish. Up on Lake Superior, if you want to get into whitefish, middle of summer, you go out into Shawamigan Bay and you fish on that green buoy that's right out in front of the lighthouse on that point that sticks way out in the water across from Washburn. And I'm telling you right now, you're going to catch some incredibly large whitefish. You can fillet them, fry them just like walleyes. You can smoke them. They bake great in the oven. Mm-hmm. If you catch them, you know, later in the season when the roe is thick in these whitefish, you can make caviar.
That's what Norquist did. He posted a bunch of pictures on social media of his whitefish caviar. And I mean, it looked delicious. I like whitefish a lot. I like it better than lake trout. I think it's a little more mild than lake trout. It's a little oilier, of course. They're in the salmon family, so a little oilier than, you know, walleye and some of our other sport fish. But really, really underrated as a sport fish. Do guys use them? How do they catch them? Like little tiny jigs? Is that what Gary Roach and other guys are using?
Yeah, they're using jigging spoons with tiny hooks.
Okay.
Because they do have a small mouth. But when you get into those bigger whitefish, you know, those fish that are up 6-8 pounds, you know, their mouth is big enough to take in the larger hooks that are on those ice fishing jigging spoons.
Okay.
And that's what these guys are catching the fish on.
I got to get out this winter. That's my goal, maybe get into some whitefish again. This is Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerieslein and Tim Lesmeister are bringing it home here today. So I guess we're talking about a cold water fish, a cold water species, Tim, and some folks are already thinking about ice. The pond behind my house was froze over earlier this week. It has opened back up with these warmer temperatures. We really got to stress safety. I wish we didn't have to do this, but there's guys that are going to be out on the skim ice.
If you don't know what you're doing, if you've never been out on early ice, just don't go. You know, there's some lakes that are freezing up north. That whole upper Midwestern region has been cold enough that some of the lakes have gotten ice, and the nights are staying cool enough that it's not thawing out quite yet. Maybe it will yet, but it's
in the Twin Cities
there.
It is. Maybe border country it's not, but the Twin Cities, I mean, overnight lows in the 40s this weekend.
Yeah, you're going to lose that ice pretty quick. But now you still got lakes that have that skim ice. Looks like it's safe. It's not. And if you've not been out on those early ice lakes, don't go. You should have, at least if you are thinking about going out, have a float suit on. And if you think that you're going to be able to get out of that ice after it breaks with those ice picks, you've got to have some good upper body strength to do that. So if you're out of shape like I am, you need to have somebody with you that's got a rope. And they get, you don't want to be walking out together. Make sure they're trailing you by about 20 feet, because if you go through, someone's going to need to pull you out with a rope. Have an ice spud. Hit that ice in front of you. If it goes through, back up as fast as you can. And make sure you got a rope on that spud, because I can't tell you how many times guys have whacked the ice. Boom! Ice spud goes right through.
Right.
And they weren't holding on to it tight enough.
Yeah.
And then I'm losing a nice ice chisel. So don't go. Just don't go out until you know for sure that you've got a good 3 inches out there and the ice is safe.
I'd say four or more, but that's that's me. Yeah, please be careful. The fish are going to be there, folks. Tim, final topic before we go. In our Beyond Minnesota section, we had a piece about Colorado. They passed a referendum out there. They wanted to reintroduce wolves, which is fine with me. I don't have a problem with that. I'm glad to see recovering wolf populations in places like Colorado. I think that state can handle a few. The Trump administration, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, telling them, though, you're not going to stock Colorado with Canadian wolves. Apparently, they were getting some from B.C., British Columbia. What do you make of that?
I think the Canadian wolves would fare well in Colorado, especially if they have them at the higher elevations.
Right. Yeah, and I'm sure that's where they're doing this, yeah.
Yeah, where they're pulling these wolves from. Oh, they're not going to – I don't think they're going to turn any loose out there in cattle country or into the wheat fields. People think that Colorado is nothing but mountains. Trust me, there's a lot of prairie out there too.
You're right.
And so, you know, you're going to have to release those wolves where they're not going to basically tear into the livestock and chew up all of the, you know, the cattle that are out there. But I'll tell you what, there's a lot of elk in Colorado. There's a lot of area there where the wolf would fare well. And I think the Canadian wolves would be the best choice. So I think that the Trump administration should probably say, hey, you know, let's take advantage of Canada just a little bit and get a few wolves out of those guys.
I know Dean Borch from Wisconsin Outdoor News said they can have some from Wisconsin. I think genetically these are all the same animals, you know, from the Great Lakes through the Intermountain West through up into Canada. I'm not exactly sure what the reasoning was for not allowing that, but there's always some new wrinkle with wolf management and wolf reintroduction, isn't there, Tim?
As soon as you take those wolves out of Wisconsin and throw them up there about 7,000 feet, they'll be anting all day long, trying to get down low so they can catch their breath.
This is horrible up here now. That's a good one, Tim. I like that. All right. Well, Tim, good luck fishing. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. We'll catch up to you soon.
That's our buddy Tim Lesmeister. Thank you to him, all of our other guests. Everybody, have yourself a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Gerieslein, signing off for Outdoor News Radio. Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.